It's just a veil for getting my way and convincing you to do it so I don't have to take the sword to you to do it.
Conservatives will fight tooth and nail to stop a new law from coming into being, but once it's law, it's never going away.
Well, you call it a rock, but it's actually more of a, you know, non-homogeneous assembly of matter.
Meaningful discourse about things could be destroyed.
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
Can I take a drink now?
No.
Okay. Part two time.
Yes. Welcome to part two. If you have not listened to part one, it'll probably be okay. But you should go listen to part one anyway to boost the stats.
Exactly. Part two of postmodernism. So this is our post-postmodernism episode.
Yes. What comes next? That's not what we're talking about.
You can make a religion out of that. And having just listened to the last 5 minutes of where we left off to remember what we were talking about.
Because we're professionals here and always plan ahead.
Indeed. Indubitably.
And by plan ahead, we mean do all the research 30 seconds before we push record.
Technically ahead.
And sometimes during the show. Actually, most times during the show.
Yeah. Thank goodness for technology. So where we left this off with was essentially getting to, I think, the real meat and potatoes of the problem with the core tenets of postmodernism. Those of which being that the subjective truth, what was the term they explicitly...
Epistemological relativism.
Yes, epistemological relativism, which is not the epistemology of your genetic relatives.
No,
that's a different thing. But, and that was, we don't exist in a vacuum.
Right.
There are others. And while... we talked about this a couple times, but I think postmodernism having roots in the literary sense, because it was like a, what, artistic literature movement before this, before it was a political movement or philosophical movement.
Yes.
One of the neat things about reading a book is that it is a unique and individual experience. So that the limiting factors are your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I touched on why certain books or stories or novels don't play well in that space, because they have varying degrees of imaginative freedom. And I guess by that I mean as far as without having to go and directly contradict something explicitly stated by the author. But in the narrative of life of human beings on planet Earth and wherever else, don't know how this is going to date. But it's not an individual experience. It's a collective experience. We're social creatures. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the things, and I think the issue that a lot of people have regarding postmodernism is when it crosses into the political realm and those implications, because politics are essentially... it's essentially just a philosophy of how we should conduct ourselves in a group.
Right. How do we get along?
Yeah.
Basically. Politics is how do we get along writ large.
Yeah. Right. Well, and the fun thing about that is that you have to consider more than one person in that system, because...
How do we get along?
Yeah. And I think a lot of the... critiques of postmodernism is that in order for your truth to be your truth and it actually be truth writ large, others have to accept it. And I think that's like the biggest stumbling block, is that you can write a bad fan fiction for yourself and no one cares, but the moment you post it online, it's going to get ripped to shreds by a bunch of other people, and then people get butthurt about that. And so they want to make them stop. Take that whole concept and experience and apply it to reality, and you just get wild things occurring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think anything really encompasses this better than discussions around, you know, identity in particular, like gender and racial identity. So the intersectional philosophy, which is undoubtedly a postmodernist philosophy, sort of.
Undoubtedly, sort of.
Well, I said undoubtedly because it is almost always undoubtedly in the way that the same people who are postmodernists will always tout this, but it also is kind of incoherent because intersectionality relies on constructing objective categories of people.
Yes. Well, I mean, everything about subjective reality is contradictory. I mean, so a very simple syllogism that I wrote one time proves that reality is not subjective. I don't know if I care to state it in the form of a syllogism, but the argument goes something like, suppose reality is entirely subjective, then it is objectively true that reality is entirely subjective. Therefore, there is reality that is not subjective. And this is a contradiction, like essentially, like it in a very pure and rote logical form, it is incoherent nonsense that reality can be subjective. Because if you say that truth is relative, you're making a truth claim.
Right. And I also feel like when philosophical movements that are coming from some other area outside of reality, practical reality, they run into this problem. But I wonder which came first, postmodern in the literary and artistic sense, and was it co-opted for political purposes, or did it really inform a political movement? And I guess the reason I say that is because I feel like the things people were wanting, and I think you wouldn't necessarily call someone, like, I don't think you'll ever see like a postmodernist party, political party, for example. They would probably call themselves progressives.
Probably.
But progressivism has existed for a long time. It's taken different shapes because, well, if you're progressing, things are changing. So what you want, once you get one thing that you want, in order to meet the T of progress, progress goes on. So you would change what it is exactly you want based on what you've gotten, just like how conservatives change based on what we had.
Yes.
You know, which is kind of funny.
What we have now keeps changing, so what conservatives defend keeps changing.
Yeah, and it also kind of makes for a very ludicrous political system in my mind, or a political set of political parties. And I think it's like really boils to a head in countries like the United States, where we are kind of by our voting system locked into a dual party system. It kind of makes sense that if one party is the party of change, the other party is going to be the party of stability and tradition.
Right.
But they're one of them.
But then this kind of creates problems because, well, this is why bad laws are so sticky in the United States, because so the conservatives will fight tooth and nail to stop a new law from coming into being, but once it's law, it's never going away.
Yeah, they will defend it to the death, and then progressives don't care. They want to make a new law.
Right.
And no,
well, they got what they wanted.
Right.
They got the law they wanted, so now they're on to the next thing. And the conservatives that were alive before may complain that that law exists, but the politicians are never going to actually change it because, well, I don't know, for whatever reason, let's take laws off the books is not a popular opinion.
No, because people want something, and to take something away is the opposite of something.
You're doing, well, yeah, it's like your job is to make laws. Why are you talking about getting rid of laws? You're doing the opposite of your job. And it's like, or I guess there might be like this perception that, well, we decided, society has decided that this is how we're going to be, so get over it, and we're doing the next thing now. Yeah.
Both attitudes exist. And
they both reinforce each other so that nothing can change.
And they're both employed by the same person at different points in time, usually. Progressives will fight and talk about how bad old laws are until they get their way. And then as long as they're alive, which is, I think, also why people tend to trend toward conservatism with age,
right, they want to defend the things that they argued for when they were younger.
Yeah. Exactly. Which I think is very unfortunate because it doesn't let you actually talk about the issue and the principles of the thing. And I think that if I could wave a wand that only had like limited scoping changes I could make, I guess, to the political system of the United States, and I guess any political system, is I would do away with that. I would much, much rather have parties that stand for particular principles and they're just different. And the public's feeling towards that principle dictates who's in charge and who makes the laws. Mm-hmm. And there's a constant back and forth of taking laws that you didn't pass, but your opposition passed, off the books to put your law in place. And you go back and forth until one of them sticks long enough that people don't argue for that it be taken off, because we've all kind of come to agree, like neither party is going to get out in front of and campaign on taking it away anymore because we're on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. Which I think some people might argue that that's exactly what we have here, is that, you know, and I think this is also kind of weird because we have a very narrow scope of, you know, time, being finite human beings, that we don't realize that the debates had hundreds of years ago are still being had today, just mm-hmm. about different things. But there have been things that we've all kind of agreed on and moved on from, right? One of the biggest ones is, you know, monarchy bad. Everyone agrees. I don't think there's now.
Except for the British.
Okay.
Are they really people, though?
No.
Lizard people. They're redcoats.
Right. But like in the American system, it's like we've all agreed monarchy's bad. But that wasn't the case then. There were still plenty of people that were looking for the next king of America. They mm-hmm. Forget that monarchy over there being ruled from afar, but who are we going to pick to be the monarch here? Mm-hmm. Right? That was where we started. And then it took a long time for one to get like, you know, this other system is better. I say that. There's probably, you can name any kind of absurd political thing, and there's probably a small group of people out there advocating for it. But by and large, the vast majority of people are not entertaining that question anymore. We moved on to other questions, you know. So I guess the way this relates to postmodernism is that when you're ascribing a worldview, were the progressives that existed before, did they just adopt postmodernism as it came about because it's the next thing, you know? Or if they did that, are they bending postmodernism to the things they wanted and using postmodernist philosophy to justify the things they wanted? Because this is kind of the neat trick about philosophy. Philosophy doesn't actually do anything. Mm-hmm. It's not a science.
No.
It's an art, arguably. And you can argue for the same thing. Like, let's just go to a concrete example. Stealing from someone else when you're stealing food from someone else when you're starving to death. Mm-hmm. Every philosophy ever has probably addressed that specific kind of question. They all have different proposals to answering it, but the actions that can be taken are finite and limited.
Right.
So you can have, if you're starting from, I'm starving right now, and I'm gonna steal it because I want to stay alive. Pick any philosophy.
Why does it matter what philosophy
yeah.
you claim to hold? You're gonna do the thing.
But remember, we love to justify our actions and reason
right,
our way
yeah.
around
the
it.
Philosophy that you pick just determines how you feel about it in the aftermath, right? So like, you know, yeah, I think a lot of philosophies, I think most of the philosophies that stick today will say something like, well, it doesn't matter, you're starving, you can do what you want to preserve your life.
But if you're not delusional, yes.
And then there are others which still have somewhat of a remote foothold of, well, it's just objectively wrong to steal the food and you should righteously starve to death. Or if we're talking about in the aftermath, since you stole the food, which was objectively wrong, you're going to be like cosmically punished for this. Either by a god or karma or whatever. It was wrong for you to do that, but the powers that be will punish you for doing that.
Sounds like future me's problem.
Right. But yeah, every philosophy has an answer to that, because as soon as you start, every moral philosophy has an answer for that, because as soon as you start talking about morals, it's like, okay, what if I'm about to die though? And I could stop myself from dying by breaking the moral principles. Then what? Like that's one of the first questions that occurs to anyone who's coming up with a system of morals.
Right. And so I guess to bring it back to the question, what are your thoughts about this? Do you think that there were progressives who were unhappy with the way the system currently was that looked at postmodernism and says, oh, I can use some of the parts of this philosophy to conveniently justify in an indefensible way what I want to achieve? Or did someone learn about did a bunch of people pick up postmodernism because they liked the idea and then turned around and apply it? Like,
I think it's both.
Okay.
I think this is true of a lot of political movements, where you have some people who do know what's going on and they have ends that they want to meet, and they can do that with word games. So they do. And then there are other people who fall for the word games and don't realize that they're playing a game and genuinely believe it.
Yeah. I think you can make the argument that any tyrannical leader of a political movement is actually a moral relativist, a pragmatist.
Right.
At the end of the day, that's what they are. But they will 100% stand
for... If I could come up with some words to convince people that my way of thinking is right, then I'm going to do that, whether I believe it or not. But people will believe it, and that gives me power to do what I want. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just so poignantly interesting how postmodernism as a philosophy speaks very highly about respecting each individual's ability to have their own unique truth. Up until the moment that your truth collides with mine, but I'm the moral relativist here, so...
Right, but I'm right, though.
But yeah. I'm right, though. And that's the thing. We,
which, by the way, is an objective truth claim, but go on.
But my objective truth claim. So, yeah, and that's, I think, where the problem is that it's... And I think what makes postmodernism so stinky to non-postmodernists is that it literally just sounds like whining and complaining about I want it my way, and you not accepting it being my way is...
Evil.
Evil. Yeah, morally wrong. Because my system says so. And it's no different than just deciding that you're the god of the universe, but powerless to do anything about it. But man, if you did, you would.
Right. I'm the god in chains.
And this brings me to something interesting that I wanted to talk about. So we talked a lot about how aesthetic preference... We didn't talk about it like this, but I'm going to put words around it because I've had this thought since the week since we discussed this last. Mm-hmm. How the role of aesthetics plays in postmodernism. So why would anybody complain about objective beauty? Why would a postmodernist if you have an issue
complaining about objective beauty has been a thing for longer than postmodernism.
It has been, but the answer that postmodernism gives, and I think that maybe what it's being used for. Let's start talking about it like it is. Okay. Postmodernism is just a framework and tool that you can use to structure a thought process and reasoning around getting what you want, right? Mm-hmm. But you have to be obsessed with aesthetics to care about them to this degree, to adopt a philosophy around them. You have to care a lot about it, right?
Okay.
And I think there's something particularly weird, because I've always had this idea based on my experience with people who are proclaimed postmodernists. As one who is not them, they are wildly fascist for being for people who usually hate fascism.
Who claim to, yeah.
Who claim to, right? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that hypocrisy to me has just never felt solvable. Like, how can you hate something so much but you're doing it? And it got me to this point where I read about the aestheticization of politics. Have you heard of this phrase before?
Not put that way.
So it's an idea first coined by a guy named Walter Benjamin. I'm reading from the Wikipedia article. As being a key ingredient to fascist regimes, Benjamin said that fascism tends towards an aestheticization of politics in the sense of a spectacle in which allows the masses to express themselves without seeing their rights recognized and without affecting their relations of ownership, which the proletarian masses aim to eliminate. And he goes on to write, fascism attempts to organize the newly proletarianized masses without affecting the property structure, which the masses strive to eliminate. Fascism sees its salvation in giving these masses not their right, but instead a chance to express themselves. The masses have a right to change property relations. Fascism seeks to give them an expression while preserving property. The logical result of fascism is the introduction of aesthetics into political life. Mankind, in which Homer's time was a spectacle for the Olympian gods, has become one for itself. Communism responds by politicizing art. So I think that right there just clicked for me when I read it the first time about what makes all of this work so much, because it's, and this is how it can be twisted when it within a postmodernist framework to be fascist without calling it that, because arguably the vast majority of people alive today have never experienced real fascism. They don't actually know.
Right. Those regimes are gone, and most people who lived through them are either dead or are too old to remember them clearly.
Right. And I'm beginning to wonder if there's if I can formulate a hypothesis around the idea that fascism is a natural consequence of modern progression, which is why we have not seen it before, and why it was a late 20th century movement. But also, I would claim that it's not just a late 20th century movement. It is something that is primed by where we've progressed to as a civilization. And the roots of what leads to fascism are still well and alive today.
Mm-hmm.
But we just don't call it that anymore because the name is bad. Because once we've named it, we've labeled it, this is bad. Anybody who calls himself a fascist is obviously bad. Everyone knows this. It's a commonly and accepted fact. But the problem with just caring so much about what it's called and not what it was.
This reminds me of a parallel.
Sure.
About pyramid schemes.
Mm-hmm.
So most people, especially in America, have heard of a pyramid scheme, and they know it's a bad thing. They may not even fully understand what a pyramid scheme is, but they know it's bad. They know it's a scam. And people are beginning now to figure out that multi-level marketing means the same thing.
Yeah.
Not everyone has figured it out yet, but they are. So the industry, if you will, of pyramid schemes have moved on to a third term called direct selling.
Yep.
Which is, so they just keep changing the name and keep fooling people, because all they're learning is, oh, I heard the magic word, so I know this is a bad thing. Well, if we make a new magic word and it's going to take society a few years to learn it, then we can keep getting away with stealing people's money.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we never addressed the core problem and never educated people. And people have never not been educated on the actual issue with it, except those who have been in it.
Mm-hmm.
Who, like, if you fell victim to a pyramid scheme, I would hope that you're a lot less likely to fall for a direct selling scheme. Now, I don't know that the statistics bear that out, because there are a lot of dopes that keep falling into the same trap more than once. Well,
this time it's going to work.
But this time...
Where have I heard that before?
Right. But what changed? Nothing. The person still wants to get rich quick, right?
Right.
That's the...
Ultimately, yeah, they didn't learn the lesson of you can't get rich quick.
Right. Just like...
Or, well, you can, but not... The way you can get rich quick is by winning the lottery, which sure. is very hard to do.
Gambling, essentially.
Yes.
Which that's been around forever, you know.
And yeah, that's another thing that people do understand. Gambling is very risky. You can make a lot of money, but you'll probably go broke.
Yeah. But they do it anyway.
They do it anyway. And it's fine if it's fun.
Right.
But don't actually try to get rich by gambling.
Right. And I'm beginning to wonder, like, is the result of democratization, how does it terminate? Because we know how monarchy terminates. It can terminate realistically one of two ways. The next monarchy, bigger army, bigger coronation diplomacy, I guess. Or we figured out, oh, we could just do a democracy, right? But we've not really watched enough democracies fall apart. Well, spoiler alert, we have. But no one seems to pay attention, and they don't blame the democracy for it. They always blame what comes after. But so far, the ways democracy has fallen apart in the modern era is in fascism or communism.
Mm-hmm.
There really isn't another outlet. You don't really see democracies going back to monarchy in the way that you could see a monarchy turning to another monarchy. And, you know,
except in Poland, maybe. We'll see about that.
Maybe in Poland. They may be the first. And I know that some people are like, well, you know, monarchy is just fascism. It's not, though. It's actually not.
It's completely different. Yeah.
It can exhibit a lot of the things that I think the uneducated might think fascism is. Because if you ask anybody what fascism is, most people will say, oh, it's a dictator. But that's
right, it's an authoritarian regime. But there are authoritarian regimes take many forms.
They do.
Fascism has a particular definition. Yeah.
Yeah. And dictators have existed long before fascism. And there's a reason we didn't just call Hitler a dictator.
Right.
He was a fascist.
Right.
And he also was elected.
Yeah, he's not a king.
He's not a king. Yeah, he did not rule by divine right.
Right.
That's the big difference. But it's an important difference. You know, so I guess where I get to with postmodernism is, how did the politics and power of this work out? And one thing I would say is that one of the ways you can see this coming out is, oh, we can just, everything's back on the table now, because for a long time, and practically all of human history, language is now back on the table. I can just change words around. Mm-hmm. And this is not a new idea. This kind of rears its head in, you know, it has reared its head in pretty much, I think, some way, shape, or form always. The church, if I go back far enough, is one of the biggest groups to blame for this.
Sure.
Look at the way witch trials worked, you know, the labeling trials, of heretics, you know.
And also just the canon of Christian thought. Like Thomas Aquinas, go read Thomas Aquinas and tell me he's not playing some severe word games. Like, and it's so long ago, I can't tell if he genuinely believed what he had to say or not. But yeah, like that was his whole thing. Any of his arguments especially the ones for God, like he just comes up with words and says, well, this is what this means. And so if we go with this definition, then this like logically must follow that so-and-so a thing is true, and we're going to call that God now. And that's why God exists. Like, that's Thomas Aquinas, basically. And everyone else who has come up with an argument for, well, yeah.
Most modern apologetics.
Yeah. Almost all, if not all, Christian apologetics or monotheistic apologetics take that form.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because I would say, or who would you say is the modern champion against postmodernism?
The modern champion against
whether you like it or not.
Kermit the Frog?
Yeah, you know it. Jordan Peterson mentions postmodernism about every breath or so.
He does use the term a lot, yes.
But he is also very Aquinas-like in his way with words.
Yes, he also loves to play word games. Yeah.
Yeah, he absolutely does. Which makes me wonder, is this one of those fighting fire with fire things? You know, because that's essentially what postmodernists are doing. My truth is that this is not fascism. I'm defining it as freedom fighting.
Right. Whatever we want to call it. Yeah.
Sure. But both are a departure from Enlightenment thinking around things matter and we need to agree on what this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
And it better be based in reality. And we both better be able to, people on opposite sides of the globe should be able to observe the same thing, and they can call it whatever they want, but they're going to observe the same thing and treat it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that's truly what brought us out of the Dark Ages
That's why we called it that.
Yeah.
We called it the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
It's when we finally figured anything out. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Dark Ages were very much, I think, caused by not Thomas Aquinas,
no,
but the thinking that he used and the way that he thought to justify the things that he wanted. It's just a veil for getting my way and convincing you to do it so I don't have to take the sword to you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because arguably, for the vast majority of human history, it was bigger sword or bigger club diplomacy. But then people realized, I can just win people over with words. And words are my playground. So much so that we even kept people from learning how to read and write. So that we could come up with these arcane words that only others of the cloth that knew how to read could see the real truth.
And then even after people did start learning how to read, they did it in different languages than what the people spoke.
Exactly. And then now that anybody can translate anything from any language to any other language, but what the translator can't do is tell you what the person who wrote it thought it meant.
Right.
And what definition...
You can only guess what most people would understand by that word when they read it, if they spoke that language.
Right. And so you've defeated the translator again. You're removing the goalpost. First it was, we're just going to write it down and then we'll tell you what it says. And that gives our agents in the field the ability to receive communications. Right,
we can tell you anything. Yeah.
Yeah. The people within the organization can tell each other the truth as they see it and communicate the message and structure. But then those in the field can tune that to their particular flock to get them to do what they need them to do. Well, then when those people learn to read, well, fine, we'll just, it's already another language anyway, so we'll just keep it there. And then when people learn to do that, then it became about, well, you don't truly understand the meaning of this. You would need to go to one of our educational institutions, i.e. be indoctrinated to understand our way of thinking, you know, because that's essentially what a seminary is. It's teaching you the actual definitions of the, you know, whimsy-whamsy words and the whole structure of logic that's being used so that you can then take it and bend it if necessary. And I'm not saying this is like the mission. This is, I'm taking the tinfoil hat off here. I'm not saying that's the mission, but in effect what actually happens. Yeah. And now it's, well, wait a minute. Why do big institutions of power have to be the ones to do that? We can do that. We, the people, can make up words and make our words mean whatever. And as long as, you know, and you see it all the time, you know, the biggest one is, what is a protest?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, what is a protest?
People getting together to complain about a thing.
Right. Does that include violence?
Maybe.
Depends on who did it, right? Was it a gang of people? A mob of people? You know, like...
Or a peaceable assembly.
It depends. You know, these words matter. And the problem is that the vast majority of people... And I think what made Enlightenment really spread and stick is that it is common. Everybody exists in reality. We can all get on board with the ideas that were brought about in the Enlightenment because we live here. You know, I don't have to just tell you what it means. I can show you what it means. And you can take that experience and understand it. You know what I mean? You don't need a tutor to teach you the ways of the words. I can demonstrate it a very simple principle to people, you know. And so there are still the masses of people that operate in that space, but you're playing with their words, you know. And I think there's a lot, and I don't know how we deal with that because it essentially is a regression. Like I would argue that postmodernism or any attempt, apologetics, any attempt to obfuscate the meaning of words, it's not only intentionally dishonest, but it's ultimately destructive to human cooperation to knowingly do so.
Well, yes, because as soon as you start muddying the waters about what words even mean, like... The more you blur you can blur the line between two words, and then eventually those words become completely interchangeable. If this repeats forever, no words mean anything. Now, I don't think that in practice, it would ever get to the point where words literally don't mean anything. Like, eventually there's a practical stopping point where people will just continue using words in a practical way. So, like, language itself is not going to be destroyed, but meaningful discourse about things could be destroyed.
Right. And I think this is, like, one of the things that was portrayed in, like, 1984, the Newspeak dictionary.
Right.
And unlike in that time, where you had to have infrastructure to print out these new speak manuals and then distribute them to your population, and even then it acknowledged that this has to be a slow process, because if you pull a fast one on somebody, people don't like that. People don't like when the rug's pulled, but much like a frog in boiling water, if you turn the temperature up slowly, they won't realize it. But now we can disseminate these things gradually via the internet,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I think realistically, that is what makes this different than what came before it, is that before, like, and why it was the church, arguably the Catholic Church, who was able to do this first, or any, it really didn't have to be the Catholic Church. It could be any big enough religious institution. If you look at where writing comes from, the vast majority of written things before the printing press were written by the religious,
mm-hmm.
you know, they didn't hold.
Although the vast majority of things done at the time were done by the religious, because most people were,
I mean,
religious. Do you mean like the clergy?
The clergy, yes. Like people directly operating within a religious system. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be necessarily clergy, but like scribes, things like that. You, mm-hmm. It was a skill that you had to develop to be in that field, and then everyone else could do without it, you know? So that's what I think gave these institutions power in that way, is that they could control the narrative across time. And that's why I think, you know, rulers almost always align with the clergy. One may have become before the other, like either the ruler sets forth what the religious doctrine is, or vice versa, but they've always been closely related. Mm-hmm. You know, a good example, if you look at Julius Caesar, a lot of the time when he was in political power in Rome, he was serving as essentially the Pontifex Maximus, or essentially the head of the Roman religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're always related. It's very rare to see a state religion, well, not a state religion, although they were. It's very rare to see a dominant religion in a place with a ruler who is of a different opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that also makes sense too, because it makes it easier to rule people that, you know, you share a common faith with. But it also really helps when you're going to do something egregious and the populace isn't going to be happy about it, to pull the, well,
God told me to.
Yeah, God told me to. And then the preacher's like, well, God, you know. but this is making a whole other thing where it's like, God didn't tell me to. I said so, but I'm using the right words, you know. And I don't know, like, and there are other things too, like gender identity is one that's interesting. It's supposed to be unique, but it isn't.
Unique?
It's supposed to be not unique, but like it could be, right? Under the postmodernist framework, it could be unique.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean,
depends on what you mean by that. But of course, we're changing definitions to suit whatever we want. So
I'm going to keep using real world definitions, but okay, the idea of the gender spectrum and fluidity of all that,
mm-hmm.
right? There, you can make up anything that you want, right? Essentially to the point where it is unique. But that's not what's ever pushed, really. That's not what's ever at the forefront. Like, no one's out there arguing for the rights of people to identify as, like, an animal, like a horse or a dog.
Well, some people are, but
that's not the forefront, though.
Oh, yeah, yes, you're right. That's not the forefront.
Instead, it's operating within the previous framework of, well, people accept the words, you know, he and she.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start by, like, flipping those, right? You see what I'm saying? Like, although creating those categories is, again, inherently opposite to the postmodernism, unless those of the postmodern regime that are collective together are agreeing. But I would argue that it's very, very unlikely, if we all have a totally subjective view of reality, that you would see that much overlap. and there not be anything objectively tying it together, mm-hmm. right? Because why are we limiting ourselves? If we're all having our own subjective experiences, why does anything have to, there shouldn't really be any correlations if nothing's objective, right? If everything's on the table, totally random, it would actually have a random distribution statistically, but it doesn't. You see what I'm saying?
I don't know that I agree with the principles of that, but...
Okay, like, well, let's hash it out, because maybe I am off base here.
Well, just because something is... Just because everything is on the table doesn't mean that certain things aren't way more statistically likely to happen than others.
But why?
Sometimes that's just how it is.
But that's not good enough, right? I'm sorry, I'm being a jerk, but like...
I mean, okay, if we want to detach it from the from postmodernism, just to illustrate the thing of that things that are technically random still can behave in predictable and unsurprising ways. Quantum physics.
Okay.
Quantum physics, basically, one of the more puzzling things about it is that almost any outcome is on the table whenever you, if you want to look at the whole picture of some interaction that you're going to predict. But almost all the time, it happens in a very predictable, classical-looking way.
Mm-hmm.
Even down to stuff like, you know, okay... Light bounces off of a mirror. It always bounces off at the same angle that it came in at, right? Wrong. But it does so often that we basically can treat it like it does. It, even though it's actually fulfilling a statistical probability distribution, it's actually random which way it's going to go. And you can prove this. But it almost always falls into one category of bouncing off at the same angle it came in at.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe my conflation of... Because when I hear random, I mean, like, I guess I was conflating that with, like, equal statistical outcome.
You're talking about, like, a uniform distribution. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where any outcome is equally likely.
Right.
But that's not how it always works. Probability can be distributed in clusters. Very tight clusters.
Hmm. Okay. Fair enough, I guess.
Now, that may or may not be relevant to the point you were trying to make. And also, just to close this whole thing, if something is done on a probability distribution and it is and everything is still possible, even though it's tightly clustered, if you have literally infinite samples, then yes, everything will be accounted for.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess.
But anyway,
yeah.
Enough of that. That's a little too abstract.
Sure. I guess with the remaining time, though, let's take this to a logical extreme, I suppose. Say, for example, we keep the current system of governments that exist, right? The way by which we decide what we're going to do, right?
Okay.
But everybody operates within a postmodernist framework. What would be the implications there? Because I would also assert that one of the things, and this I will give credit here, I do think that one of the things that postmodernists, because they are right about some things, you know, and any good philosophy does overlap with the truth to some degree to make it easier to stomach, you know. One of the things being that, like, to take it back to gender roles, why these two? Like, why are we just talking about flipping between these two and not all possibles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, and why are we seeing people identifying at a vastly increasing rate than we've seen in the past? Well, arguably,
because it's more socially acceptable now.
Right. Yeah. The regimes of the past forced people into these things. We're deconstructing that regime so that we can now open those things up.
Our lives how we want. Yeah.
And I think the argument there would be that if this regime never had existed, this would have always been the case. And we don't actually know what the realistic statistical distribution would be because we've not been in a system that allows for all the options long enough,
mm-hmm.
you know. So critiques like that, and the idea of analyzing things from the perspective of essentially combating, this is just the way it's been done, right? Yes, I agree there. Like the complaints that I think a postmodernist would have about conservatives, 100% agree. Mm-hmm. I am not a conservative. I also agree that doing things just because that's the way we've done them is not a good reason to keep doing them.
Right.
Sure. And I have no issues there. But I also, but taking these things to a logical extreme, you know, a logical extreme, I think, for conservatives would be that nothing would ever change. Like the system would continue to reinforce the things that it has reinforced forever. And you would see an eventual stagnation and inability to address changing circumstance. That's its death knell, is the situations that created the tradition change, and the new tradition, and the tradition is now no longer able to handle a new circumstance. But because you adhere to it so tightly, you fail, right? That's, I think, that's how you play out the scenario of the conservative arc. How would you feel a postmodernist arc would play out in that way?
It's hard to say. It feels like it could go a lot of different directions.
Mm-hmm.
Like one conclusion is anarchy.
Sure.
Nothing matters. Institutions don't matter. So we should do away with them. And we do.
Yeah.
That's one possible outcome. The other possible outcome is that, running into the practicality, the practical issues of asserting subjective truth,
mm-hmm.
which is that, okay, but eventually people are going to cluster together and agree that this is the truth and impose their will on other people.
Right.
And they would probably, if they were to still remain within the postmodernist framework, then they would abuse language to get other people on board and impose their will that way, and create some sort of, well, I guess regime is the best word for it. I don't know exactly what form that would take per se. Or if we wanted to think about, okay, if we want to talk about like ways that the society could fail, if we want to call it failure, you know, if we chip away at the appreciation for truth and enlightenment thinking, then basically science is abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And we devolve back to pre-scientific technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be called a failure.
Sure. Well, I think, yeah, I guess failure, it would be like, I guess the better question I should have asked.
What does failure actually mean? Yeah.
Well, I guess failure would mean like decline to the point where it can no longer sustain itself as a political system, because that was the
right. Confines. Okay. So if there's a postmodernist society, then yes, it abandons science and regresses in technology and some other society consumes it.
Right. And I think that's the biggest problem that I see. And you also run into the same problem that the conservatives run into, but instead of addressing that there is a problem, but being unwilling to change to face it, you just pretend the problem doesn't exist because it's not your truth up until it happens. Like,
right. Until the men with guns are showing up and telling you to do stuff.
Well, yeah. It didn't even have to be that. Like, let's imagine a society that, let's imagine a conservative society that's based around some principles and traditions of humans belong on Earth. Humans should never go into space and humans should not look to the stars. And the belief that a god protects the Earth from everything, right? And then we find out, oh, there is a comet on the edge of the solar system that is on a direct impact. I don't know how we would find this out if we don't even look to the stars. But still, say they do find that out, because they do also...
Well, people break the rules. So some astronomer breaks the rules and says, okay, in 1,000 years, this comet is going to collide with Earth and destroy it. What do we do?
Right. Well, we're not going to do anything. Like, the answers would be, well, we can't go into space because that's God's domain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing we can do until it gets here. And by the time it's here, it's too late. Right.
Right.
So the best thing they may do is like build bunkers to protect themselves, which are going to be fruitless.
Right, we're just asserting that this is big enough to annihilate the Earth, right?
Right.
The whole planet's gone.
Or there'd be mass appeals to the God figure to make it go away.
Right, God can push it out of the way, yeah.
Yeah, or maybe this was meant to be by God, whatever. Maybe this is the Armageddon apocalypse. This is foretold in the
prophecy, yeah.
Yeah, and this is the way it was always going to be, but we should still live out our lives to the good, and eventually everyone dies. I think the postmodernist way of addressing this problem would be that, oh, well, I actually, it's not a comet, it's actually a fragmented planetoid, so we're fine. Even though,
ignoring the fact that a big rock is going to smack into Earth and destroy it, yes.
Well, you call it a rock, but it's actually more of a
boulder.
It's actually more of a, you know, non-homogeneous assembly of matter, you know. And anyone who calls it a rock is just a fear-mongering bigot.
Right.
And we spend all our time caring,
arguing about what to call it, and then we die.
Yeah. And so, again, that's, I think, the core failing, is that at some point, we all need to look at the thing and go, it doesn't matter what we call it, it's going to kill everybody, we can all...
Unless we actually do something about it, so shut up, and let's do it.
Yeah. And that's an extreme example, but I think it even plays out in small examples. You can look at a couple of examples of how this results in how government money is spent. You could argue that there are probably some things more important than, like... How we address homelessness is a great example, I think. There are policies and initiatives that do a lot more trying to obfuscate the ugliness that is the scourge of homelessness. And I'm not referring to the homeless.
Well, they're not homeless. They're untethered.
They're untethered, yeah. Whatever. Right. They're van life. You know, they're nomads.
They're mobile.
You know. Same thing when it comes to like the indigenous, right? And the fact that I even called them that makes me feel terrible. Indians in America, mm-hmm. You know, there are people who spend more time being upset about how I even refer to that group that know nothing about the actual problems that they face. You know what I mean? Because that's
right. Have they ever even talked to one? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong. I think one of the big benefits to postmodernism is that it's the most attainable philosophy ever because it can be whatever you want it to be. And you don't have to lift a finger to change any problem ever. You can just decide it's not a problem anymore, which is not how humans work. We love to have problems to complain about. So you can make anything a problem and also, you know, decide its priority, which to be fair is something we do anyway.
Yes.
But you can just forget the fact that it's how important it is to anyone else because it's that doesn't matter, you know, because those other people don't matter. It's about my truth. My truth says that this is a problem. This is
most important, yeah.
Right. And it makes it very, very easy to, like, I think the best example of this is having a big committee sitting around a table, like a big wooden table somewhere, and... Again, I think I hearkened to this in the previous episode, but the show Chernobyl, if you've never seen it, I highly recommend it. I know that it's not easily attainable, but it's really, really good for, I think, showing the lengths to which absurdity can go in the blatant face of a catastrophe. But, you know, there's a group of people, an executive committee sitting around a table, and there's an actual huge problem right up the road. There's a nuclear reactor spilling radiation into the environment, poisoning it. But one person gives a very aesthetically pleasing speech about how Vladimir Lenin would be proud of the men that day who were sealing off the city and protecting the people from themselves. And they all stand up and clap for each other. And it feels great. You know, it's a very triumphant moment juxtaposed with all of those executive committee members, none of which who know anything about a power plant or have anything to do or know anything about how to actually solve the problem, but are in charge of making decisions and have decided that this isn't a problem, leave the room. And then one of the technicians that worked at the nuclear plant walks in and tells the two members that are like the linkage between this group and the people who are actually responsible for this catastrophe. This technician walks in and tells them that this is a huge problem. And instead of listening to him, they sit there and interrogate him for hours until he changes his story and says that it isn't a problem. Because that's easier than walking outside to try to figure out how to deal with a, you know, cracked open nuclear reactor, right?
Right.
I think everybody loves to talk about their problems more than actually solve their problems. it's easy, you know. Kony 2012, one like, one child saved, you know. But yeah, I guess that's my biggest critique. And I think this extends even into like activists, you know, who do something, right? But by the time you get motivated enough to do something, you've probably lost the thread on what it was you were trying to even do in the first place, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe my summary of all of this would be any way of solving a problem that is not problem and solution centric is a suboptimal at best, nefarious at worst way to address anything. And this can be something that can be laid at the feet of the postmodernist or the conservative or whomever, you know, both of which love to spend way more time talking about things other than actually talking about solving the problem than they do actually solving the problem. And I think that honestly also is one of the biggest failings of maybe even the democratic system, because we elect representatives, but no representative ever solves a problem. You know, like we elect people to government who it is their entire job to discuss the problem and find out how to solve the problem, but in no way are they ever going to actually be the ones to solve the problem. And that departure, you know, is I think one of the biggest issues I have, is that you put people in positions of power who are usually the people who lack the capability of actually solving the problem.
Right. They're woefully incompetent at actually doing things. Yeah.
Right. And then that the divorce of the capable from the authorized, I think is one of the biggest problems. And all of these things fall downstream from that. And I think when you see the movements that end up taking power, one thing that communism and fascism at their beginning have in common is it's a person who actually is going to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you get to that person, you've walked so far off of what you actually should do or what the whole real problem
was.
Right,
you've already failed. Yeah.
Yeah. Hitler was elected not because Germans hated the Jews or anyone else. He was elected because the economy sucked and people were starving and inflation was rampant.
Right.
But by the time he got into power, he was so off on a tangent about becoming the master race that's where he went once he had the power to do it. You know, Lenin and Trotsky, it was about the same thing. The impoverished, sick, starving, dying Russians, of which there were some. But by the time that the person who actually was capable of doing anything about it, Stalin, gets into power, it's now about crushing the bourgeoisie, you know? Mm-hmm. And not only that, but killing the fascist and also the Jews, like, because they seem to just get the bad end of the stick regardless.
Yeah. History's favorite punching bag.
It really is, you know? Yeah, I think I'm done talking about postmodernism for a while.
You think so?
I really do. I'm sick of it.
I have an idea for part three.
No. What's the idea?
One thing we didn't talk about that is a large part of postmodernist thinking is critical theory.
That's true. Can we just call it the episode?
We can call it critical theory instead of postmodernism. Join us next week for postmodernism part critical theory.
No. Okay. I'm sure a week from now I'll be over it and be ready to talk about it again.
Okay.
if the dog barking outside survives that long.
Yes, enjoy the dog barking outside.
Ooh.
Yeah, the dog will stop barking now that we've
of course
referenced the dog. Yes.
Now that the threat has been made. The barking will continue until morale improves. All right. Well, until part three, philosophers.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com. Philosophers is supported by viewers like you. If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.